Welcome back, readers and romance seekers, to Hopelessly Romantic Behind the Page. I am not going to say that I think I've gotten back into a proper schedule these days, because certainly that will jinx my luck, and I am definitely not going to say that things have calmed down, really, because that is most certainly not the case. But I have gotten into the new rhythm of things around here. What with the whole parenthood thing at all. And I feel as though that I am treading the waters of parenthood rather than trying to float in a Category 5 hurricane. I'm a Floridian, so I'm allowed to make that joke. It is very likely. I will admit that the chaos of my life might have kind of inhibited my ability for a truly unbiased review for the last couple of books before our last one. But I think I am definitely still going to stand behind my final thoughts and scores for them, especially for Her Honorable Mercenary. That was the sort of book that might have required a quiet, undisturbed reading experience, which isn't great for people like me, you know, the stay-at-home parents with part-time jobs and commitments who juggle the needs of the entire household while trying to find whatever limited time that they can get for themselves. And a deal with the Elf King was exactly what the doctor called for. I do feel maybe a little bit of guilt for how hard I came for Kova's writing in my review. Because really at the heart, I am in awe of what she has been able to accomplish. I would still stand by what I said about her style of writing, but that really shouldn't take away from the fact that she's not only writing as many books as she likes, but she's also running an entire publishing company on top of it. It doesn't matter that it's a micro press. I am still amazed at this accomplishment, and personally, I'm really not sure if I could do the same. Because when I think about it, things have changed so much from when I was younger. And now that I've got on to, like, you know, the parenthood side of things, I'm really becoming more increasingly aware of how much. For example, I did not get a cell phone until I was 17, I think. And this is one of those Nokia bricks that you could just chuck into a boulder and the boulder would split open. Texting was absolutely out of the question, as it was 10 cents a pop, and internet access was unthinkable. Like, the best games we had on those phones was Snake. Like, you were lucky if you had Snake. The kids today have smartphones because it's a different world the way it is. Connectivity has exploded, and kids need the ability today to keep in touch with their friends, because it's not like we've got landlines anymore that shut down when you have to hop onto the internet. Very separate, but another one is online dating. So when I was in college, online dating was the loser's way out. Someone was so desperate for a partner that they were advertising themselves on the internet. The scandal. And in just a few days, I'm going to celebrate my 6th wedding anniversary with the guy I met online. Self-publishing has seen a similar transformation. Back in the day, you could call it vanity publishing, and it would be implied that an author only did it because they just couldn't hack it in the publishing world, and they would have to pay through the nose to do it. I remember just hearing about, like, people are like, oh yeah, I had to pay a couple $1,000s for this. And you're like, oh wow, you really wanted to be that desperate to publish your books, huh? But these days, anyone can write up a manuscript, submit it to Amazon or whoever, and be able to sell their novel as an ebook. And people have managed some solid success this way. The world is so different, and now we've thrown away the yoke of the mainstream to live out our bliss and share our stories with the world. Okay, that might be a bit dramatic, but you get my point. But really, so what Kova's done is, to me, monumental. She didn't make her publishing house because she couldn't hack it with mainstream publishers. She did it because she wanted to. And I don't think anyone would do something that big if they didn't want to do it. And really, when I get down into the nitty-gritty, I had a lot of fun reading A Deal with the Elf King. I knew what the book knew what it was and what it was here to do, and it delivered on all points. With that said, let's talk about Mary Sue's. If you don't know, a Mary Sue is, at the core, a female character who was almost perfect, with zero flaws, to the point of being boring. Some might go as far to say that Mary Sues are author self-inserts. The concept of the Mary Sue is also sexist in principle. The term originates from a parody short story that satirized the type of idealistic female characters running rampant in Star Trek fanfiction. This is back in the 70s, by the way. Star Trek fanfiction has been around probably longer than Star Trek. There is a fair bit of discourse around the Mary Sue archetype, but it's usually used to sling mud at female authors when they present readers with a capable female lead. There is a male equivalent, the Gary Stu, but you don't see Luke Skywalker getting that label, even though he hits the trope in every way. Rey, from the new Star Wars trilogy, does, however. It doesn't matter that her story lines up with Luke's beat for beat, that she's just as capable as Luke was when he started his journey. She is a Mary Sue, but Luke is just Luke. You see where I'm coming from? In my completely unsupported and unscholarly opinion, I suspect that this has a lot to do with representation in media. Women and girls want so much to be represented beyond, they want to be represented beyond either evil seductresses or the sexy lamp. So they write stories where they are the heroes, where they can face the odds just as well as the male heroes can. And they probably do some self-insert, yeah, and the characters are really not very flawed. And the moment that they do this, they get called Mary Sues. I can see Luella getting that Mary Sue label. In fact, I thought to myself more than once while I was reading that this is a Mary Sue. But I didn't put a negative connotation on it. It's just a classification of character. Luella is smart, compassionate, and selfless to a fault. When her friend fainted at the beginning of the story, she really didn't think twice to step in, even as the Elf King was staring her down, even as Luke was, you know, trying to pull her out by her hair to, like, let's go, because the idiot that he is. Luella only wanted to leave the Mythscape because she was the only healer that Captain had, and her whole town had pooled their resources together so that she could get the education that she needed to become a healer. She didn't weep over Luke for very long because she had things to do and Luke was stupid. Yes, Luella and Eldest butt heads quite a bit, but that was because she was righteous in her anger and knew her position in a way Eldest never could until he saw it from her perspective. But the idea of the Mary Sue is just a character archetype. There's boatloads of Gary Stews, or Marty Sues as they're sometimes called, but they don't get called out the way a Mary Sue does. You could take any action hero from any film or book and turn him into a woman, and instantly people would call her a Mary Sue. This is a generalization, yes, but the disparity exists, and I'm kind of sick of it. Who cares if the hero saves the day and gets romance at the end with little character flaws? We read these stories to feel good. Of course they're going to be a little self-indulgent. And speaking of self-indulgence, let's switch gears to something completely different. Themes and retellings. Oh, did you think that I was going to go into what I read this week? Ha! Gotcha. So yeah, it's obvious that this is a Beauty and the Beast rehash, but here's the thing. The original Beauty and the Beast itself is a rehash. And when I say original, I mean the French publication from about 1740. Woman is forced to wed a monster. That's a format that's existed since stories have existed. One of the more famous versions of this had elements that A Deal with the Elf King borrowed quite a bit. The story of Hades and Persephone. That's why I titled the episode, I Have a Craving for Some Pomegranate. This is probably one of my favorite myths in Greek mythology, not for just its content, but because it's been transformed so much over the years that it gives us a visual on how stories can change based on the culture that it passes through, who's telling it, who it's being told to. The best known version of the myth can be found in the Hymn to Demeter by Homer. It's a Homeric hymn. Essentially, Hades desired Persephone, and her father, Zeus, gave the A-okay for Hades to kidnap her and marry her. This is what we would call a bad look in today's modern world. But really, the ancient Greeks would not have seen it that way. Arranged marriages happen all the dang time, and some might even say that the concept of marriage was not dissimilar from our modern notion of kidnapping. By the end of the story, Persephone has had to spend a portion of the year in the underworld with Hades, and a portion in the mortal world so that she could bring about spring, or her mother does, it varies by telling. The amount of time that she spends, I think, also varies from telling to telling. I like to consider it like, you know, the six months in, 6 months out, aligning with the equinoxes. And also by Greek mythology standards, Persephone and Hades have the most functional relationship by far of all of the other Greek gods. They protect each other, they don't cheat on one another, and they act as equals in their roles of ruling the underworld. So, one of my dogs is named Hades. He is a pit bull mix that we rescued from the shelter. And people sometimes ask me, like, why did you call him Hades? Like, that's a bad guy? No. I thought Hades would be really good because, much like the mythological, the god Hades, pit bulls have been maligned by modern and American media to the point of resembling monsters. These days, if modern writers want to invoke Hades, they often shape him into a Satan figure, fire and brimstone and all that. I recently just watched, you know, Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief, and it's, you know, a villain, like not super villainous, but he's still a villain in fire and whatnot. If Persephone is mentioned, she's always a prisoner against her will, more or less. There are a few exceptions, and I've even mentioned a couple on the show. The webcomic Lore Olympus and the video game Hades are two of my favorite examples. I think there was a reference in Xena, Warrior Princess. I can't remember exactly. But a deal with the Elf King dances the line between the Hades and Persephone and Beauty and the Beast. The themes of life and death were rampant throughout the book, and the author herself even mentions Hades and Persephone on the book's marketing. The cycle of bringing summer and winter to the Midscape were more than similar to Persephone's journey in and out of the underworld, and the difficulties between the couple were almost straight out of most modern versions of Beauty and the Beast. Alright, so I've gone on about this long enough, I think. It's time for real that we're going to check out what Heather's been reading this week. And this week, I read The Martian by Andy Weir. This is a reread for me, and instead of my usual audiobooks, I was actually reading my paper copy book for this, because I've recently learned something that really, really grinds my gears. So you've probably heard me talk about Libby. I use that to borrow audiobooks from libraries, and I was surprised that a big hit like The Martian doesn't have any audiobooks available. My Indianapolis library card is unfortunately expired. I got a lot of my media that way. So I went hunting for The Martian, and I discovered that the original audiobook, first read by R.C. Bray, it's essentially disappeared. And now it's been replaced by a version read by Will Wheaton. And much to my dismay, it is only available on Audible. All respect to Will, he's a talented narrator and actor, but the fact that I can't access a book not explicitly published for Amazon from any library is heinous. I know that's a heavy word, but I mean it, because this is not a good precedent. I can't even get the original audiobook anywhere. Amazon has decided that they are big enough and important enough to keep this audiobook away from people who might need the format. Do you want to know the reason that I use audiobooks? I've talked a little about it before, mostly because of time that I say, but the big number one reason is because I have ADHD. Long gone are the days from school where I could consume paper copy books at breakneck speed when I should have been doing math homework. I cannot sit and focus on books the way I used to do. I don't even have that kind of time anymore anyway. Audiobooks are a form of accessibility for me because of my time and because of my mental disability. Being able for me to call my ADHD and mental disability, it's hard for me. I really don't like to think of it that way, since I manage it pretty well these days with very little executive dysfunction, and I more or less have it under control, but I'm taking out the classification because I needed to drive this point home. One reason is because I have accessibility in my books. Audiobooks are a form of accessibility. If I had been blinded late in life and could not pick up Braille as quickly as I would have liked, it would be the same thing. And not everyone can afford Audible, not even the basic Audible, because your first level of Audible doesn't even have any mainstream books on it. It's just Audible originals and podcasts. It's all it is. And not everyone could afford the next tier up. And even at the next tier up, you only get like maybe one book a month. In our days of streaming, we can't have a subscription to every service that's thrown at us. And for moral reasons, I avoid Amazon as much as I can. But I have the luxury of doing that. Not everyone can afford non-Amazon prices. Not everyone can get a library card. And not everyone can get paper books. Amazon is creating a world where they can hold media as tight as they want because they are big enough, rich enough, and strong enough to get away with it. To me, it's different than visual media like Netflix or something, because like their shows and movies, books to me are sacred. And The Martian is a book that should not have been guarded by Bezos like a dragon guarding his bloating hoard. I've wanted to pick up The Martian for a while now, but again, time. The only reason I was able to get it read was because we had recently gone to an air show several hours away, and I was able to knock out most of the book in the car. And it helps that I already knew the story. I didn't have to spend so much energy on understanding what was coming at me. And I also wanted to read it as prep for Andy Weir's Project Hail Mary. The books, as far as I know, have nothing to do with one another, but I wanted to tune my reading brain into Weir's style to ease my experience for the paper version. Because, again, fucking Amazon has put it on Audible Originals. But before I totally lose it, go read The Martian if you haven't already. It's fantastic. Even if you don't like scientific fiction, I'm not going to call it sci-fi exactly, because I'm not sure if it fully fits the bill. It's an amazing read, and it's one of those things that you should go into blind. And if you need the audiobook but don't have the Audible account for it, well, yo-ho, yo-ho, and all that. So that'll be it for me this week. I will see you all again next week when we read A Duke at the Door by Susanna Allen. Thank you for joining me, readers and romance seekers, and I hope to see you once again for Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, please visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. If you have questions or want to recommend a read, please email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. Also, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will go a long way to help the show, and I can keep bringing you lots of fun episodes. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster. Our technical advisor is Kwang Yun Cho. Hopelessly Romantic is an H with K production. And it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.